All right, well, way back when I was in grad school, a year ago, we had this sort of eccentric prof who decided that the best way for us to start the seminar class on film was to have us read this book by an art critic slash professor about a painting by this guy named Nicolas Poussin. So it doesn't really connect, and it didn't really, I still don't know how it connected back then, but the book sort of stuck with me, because it was this book that basically turned into a record of this writer's obsession about this painting, because he went back to this museum where the painting was every day for 4 months to just look at the painting and write notes, and then he turned that into a book. And it got really kind of weird towards the end. But yeah, an interesting read nonetheless. So, now, as strange as that sounds, I've always had somewhat of a kind of obsessive personality, and so there's something oddly attractive to me about dedicating that kind of time to a work and really to understand it. And so a few months ago, when I said I would speak this week, I decided that I was going to go and spend a month, and every day I was going to go and read the Sermon on the Mount, because that's what I wanted to do, and take notes and write about it. I was going to do this every day for a month. But unfortunately, or maybe fortunately for you, my ambition sometimes outweighs my ability. So it didn't happen. I'm not a professor on sabbatical like that writer. I can't go every day. I have a full-time job and friends and family. I also moved. These are all just excuses. But anyway, the point is it didn't happen. I managed to read through it, I think, about 3 times. And take some notes on it, and that one's about it. I'm still kind of intrigued by the idea, though. So maybe next time, or maybe sometime, I will give that sermon. I don't know. Today's will be on a much smaller section of the Sermon on the Mount. Now, part of the reason is, obviously, it's tough to go through reading like that. But the other thing is, it's not really fair, I feel like, to that text to try and cram it into 45 minutes. And it's not really fair to you if I were to do the text justice, which would take about 2 or 3 hours, probably. So, you know, you're welcome. That you'll get out of here for lunch. The other reason I found this endeavor really to be kind of impossible is because I found myself just having to stop so often reading through this text. I would sit alone in my living room, and I would try and rationalize everything that Jesus was saying here. I'd attempt to wrap my mind around these difficult passages and how they could fit into my understanding of the world. I would try to match my own personality against the Beatitudes. And I would try to gauge my level of generosity in light of Christ's calls to care for the poor. Mostly, though, I tried to just rationalize out of existence the things that I found troubling, so that I wouldn't have to live up to them. So as you can see, the job of reading these 3 chapters becomes quite an arduous task when, after every second verse, I'm stopping to reconsider my entire life up until that point. But of course, that really is the point of great writing, and the Sermon on the Mount is great writing. And in the blurb this week, I mentioned this quote from Leonard Cohen, and I started to really understand it. When he's talking about democracy, and he says that it's coming from the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. And so if Cohen can't figure it out, I don't know. But I'll try and shed some light on it. So basically, yeah, I want to focus on just, there's 3 verses that I think really connect well to each other. They connect well to what I think Christ's sort of whole ethos was and is. And also because this is Christmas time, I'm going to try and incorporate a bit of that. And so we're going to think about these in light of the season that we're in, and in light of that story, the story of Christ's coming that we're remembering right now. So I'm just going to read them all in a row and just kind of listen to them, let them sink in, and think about it, and then just sort of let them reflect as we keep talking today. So the first one's Matthew 5, 21 through 22. It says, "You've heard that the law of Moses says, 'Do not murder.' If you commit murder, you are subject to judgment. But I say, if you are angry with someone, you are subject to judgment. If you say to your friend, 'You idiot,' you are in danger of being brought before the court. And if you curse someone, you are in danger of the fires of hell." It's a positive one. The next one is same chapter, chapter 5, verse 43. "You've heard it, the law of Moses says, 'Love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. In that way you will be acting as a true child of your Father in heaven. For he gives sunlight to both the evil and the good, and he sends rain on the just and the unjust too. If you love only those who love you, what good is that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. If you are kind only to your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. But you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. And then the last one is just carrying on from there, chapter 6, 1 through 4. Take care. Don't do your good deeds publicly to be admired, because then you will lose the reward from your Father in heaven. When you give a gift to someone in need, don't shout about it, as the hypocrites do, blowing trumpets in synagogues and in the streets to call attention to their acts of charity. I assure you, they have received all the reward they will ever get. But when you give to someone, don't tell your left hand what your right hand is doing. Give your gifts in secret, and your Father, who knows all secrets, will reward you. So those are kind of the three small part of the whole sermon, inaugural speech of Christ that I want to think about. Now, what I find so challenging, and the reason I picked those two, because they fit together, but those were the ones that would always stop me while I was reading. And I think what I find so challenging about them is that they sort of instantly transport me back to my teenage years. Now, I was not a teenager who was always predisposed to doing the right thing. However, I was also a teenager who didn't like to get in trouble, as opposed to one of my older brothers who seemed to love getting in trouble. So as a person who, as a teenager, I sort of believed the Bible just enough to feel like I was definitely going to hell. And so I was always looking for these sort of quick solutions for lessening the growing mountain of sins that I was committing. So, and I wanted there to be a formula, sort of an incantation, something I could say that would instantly absolve my wrongdoings and allow me to continue on with a clean slate. So during these times, even though I didn't really believe in God, sometimes at all, I would make sure that the last thing I did before I went to bed was just do a quick prayer for forgiveness of all my sins for that day, so that just in case I died during the night, I would get into heaven, because he would wipe that clean. And I figured that was it. This was all I needed to do. As long as I didn't die like at 10:30, you know, when I was watching Letterman or something, I could get in. So now the problem with that kind of system, there's lots of problems with that kind of system, but the big one is that when you sort of start taking comfort in these rigid systems of grace, you also have to believe that the opposite is true. So passages like the ones that we read could be read very much as rigid sort of rules, and this is, you have to sort of do certain things and this will happen. If you don't do those things, then, or if you do the opposite, then bad things will happen. And so when I would read something like that, it's very black and white, it would bother me because I figured I'm doomed no matter what. Especially that verse 48 in chapter 5 where it says, you are to be perfect even as your Father is perfect. Father in heaven is perfect. That one seems tough. And it seemed really tough back then because I knew that my Father in heaven was not smoking cigarettes behind the utility shed at school. I knew he wasn't using swear words just because he liked the way they sound. And I knew that he definitely hadn't made as many clumsy attempts at seduction of youth group girls as I had. Almost, I would say 99% failed. So it was troubling, because I sort of looked at it as a very strict set of rules. But this funny thing happened sort of along my journey where I discovered things like nuance and metaphor and parable and poetics. And I realized that even when Christ is teaching, he's using language that can be sort of read in multiple ways. And that's not to say that Christ had no specific message and that the interpretation of everything is just left up to us. But it's sort of what I'm trying to describe is a shift in understanding language as a tool of communication. You see, like, I was brought up in this tradition where you tried to do a literal interpretation of everything so that you could avoid interpreting anything. Because a literal interpretation, apparently, of a translated text with its own biases is not a translation, or not an interpretation. And so that's sort of how I came up. And so I understood that if I hated somebody, That was as bad as if I had killed a that person. And so when I was 8 years old, I would sometimes walk around with the guilt of a serial killer because I sure hated my brothers a lot of times. And I definitely hated that kid at the park who always hogged the slide until we found out that we were both really into Batman, and then we were friends. I don't know whatever happened to that guy. But anyway, I should find him on Facebook maybe. So what I've come to realize since I was 8 years old is that Christ was not coming to create a new set of rules, but rather that he's talking about connection, and sort of human connection. The idea is when a person murders somebody, they've severed any chance for connection. A dead person isn't making new friends, nor is there any chance of reconciliation between the murderer or that person that they murdered. But the act of hating or insulting a person or degrading a person creates a serious disconnect as well. And so to kind of get into that, I want to show this clip. It's from a movie from the early 80s called My Dinner with Andre. So it looks a little bit hokey, but I hope you can get past that because the ideas are just incredible. And I'm just going to show about like 6 minutes of it, and it's just so packed full of like really great ideas. And this movie's an hour and a half of these two guys having dinner together. If you ever want to have a night where you just want to really engage great ideas with friends, you should check this movie out because it's unbelievable. So we're going to look at that. The one guy in it is this guy, Wally Shaw, who you'll probably recognize from The Princess Bride. This was before that. He's actually quite an accomplished writer. But he sounds funny when he talks. So. Anyway, let's... Alright, so there's a ton of ideas in there. We're not even going to touch on half of them. But I just want to kind of dig into that a bit. I think it illuminates a little bit what Jesus is saying. The first thing, though, too, when he talks about this idea of the electric blanket as being a separation from reality. Do they even make electric blankets anymore? I feel like, yeah, they're okay. I thought maybe they were illegal now or something. But... I think that would have been a big thing in the early 80s, electric blankets. You could replace that with any sort of technology now that sort of promises to help you arrive at your goal via a much easier route. You could replace it with an iPhone or your Samsung. you just think about the promise of like a smartphone, an iPhone. It promises you instant connection to all of the world's knowledge so that you can be the ultimate communicator. It gives you all sorts of apps which are promised to make your life easier and give you more leisure time to spend with your friends and your family. But what ends up happening most of the time is that we spend that leisure time with our faces glued to tiny screens scrolling through Facebook or Twitter. Products that also promise to bring you connection with your friends and the world around you without that pesky problem of actually having to see each other or talk to each other. So instead of actually communicating with your actual friend, you're connected to the online personality which he or she chooses to present to the world. Instead of finding out what your friend cares about, you get to see what she's eating for dinner. Instead of hearing about what is heavy on your friend's heart, you get to see embarrassing pictures of him from the bar the night before. Instead of talking to your friend about his struggling marriage, you get to see in your newsfeed that so-and-so is now single. Instead of discussing the depression that's eating away at your friend, you see pictures of her trying to look cute so that someone will like her picture or comment that she's beautiful. And in those few seconds, she can forget that her self-esteem is at an all-time low and that she goes to bed each night wondering if she'll ever share it with someone else. And this is the disconnect of a connection made too easy. This is what Andre is on about when he says that he would never use an electric blanket. He wants the real connection. He wants to truly know someone. If he's going to be warm with another person, he wants that warmth to be authentic, not manufactured, not artificial. And this is the same thing that Christ is on about in the Sermon on the Mount. He wants an authentic connection. He knows that human beings thrive on relationships. The true happiness doesn't come from geography or technology, wealth or influence or even one's eschatology. When Christ says that to hate your brother is the same as killing him, he's not speaking in literal terms, obviously. What he means is that to hate another person is to see them as lesser, I cannot accept that someone else is a fully developed, interesting person with wonderful ideas and moments of grace and beauty and love in her heart when I allow myself to be blinded by the portion of her personality that I find abhorrent. Nobody really just hates one part of a person. Nobody says, every time he talks, I just want to strangle him. But I love it when he sings. So lovely. Or people don't say, she is completely disgusting to me, but have you tried her cookies? Because they're great. No, hate infests every part of our thoughts about a person. Have you ever had the experience of maybe like eating something and thinking, this is really great, and someone says, oh yeah, so-and-so made that, and you just want to spit it out? I don't know, I have. Maybe my emotions get a little too out of hand. But I was letting my perception of this person dictate even my taste buds. I didn't want to accept that someone I disliked could create something I liked. Hate causes us to reduce another human being to nothing more than a caricature of who they really are. And so when another person ceases to be, in our imagination, a fully realized human being, there is an act of murder being committed. By refusing to take into account a person's entire life, we are killing that life. And chances are we will spread that opinion in an attempt to make others agree, and the life of that person will become even less in the eyes of even more. And this is what Andre is talking about with regard to his doorman. He says that there's a kind of murder going on when his doorman calls him Mr. Gregory, and he calls his doorman Jimmy. By creating this hierarchy, one person is given priority over the other. One is a fully realized human being deserving of respect, and the other is a lowly doorman, not even deserving of the common courtesy of being addressed like an adult. And I think this leads directly into Christ's teaching about loving our enemies. And of course, we all know that we shouldn't treat someone who's done us no wrong badly. We should treat them with love. But Christ takes this even further. And he says that we also have to love our enemies. And when he says this, he's speaking on both a personal and a national level. Of course, Israel was an occupied country at the time. And in the ancient Near East, there were constant wars and national enemies that were easy to identify. And I hope for your sake, none of you have enemies. I don't think I have any personally, although there may be people out there who consider me an enemy. I don't know. I hope not. But what I think Christ is referring to, this idea of an enemy, is a person who, by all worldly justice standards, you have the right to hate. Someone that has done you some unforgivable wrong, or at least a wrong that has yet to be forgiven. Or some people group that your culture sees as justifiable, as the justifiable recipient of your collective hate. These are the sorts of people that it would seem you are justified in seeing as less than human. These are the persons that can be murdered, either literally or figuratively, because they have done you some unrepentant wrong, which makes them lesser. In our current context, this might be the guy on the bus who thinks he's in a phone booth. always bothers me. This is that neighbor who won't stop shoveling his snow onto your driveway. This is the woman in the parking lot who steals your spot at Christmas time. But this is also the man who your wife is cheating on you with. This is the terrorist group that took down 2 skyscrapers with airplanes. This is the insane person who shoots up a movie theater or a school and kills your child. And this is also... Yesterday I was reading things and came across a leader of some sort of gun rights group who said that this whole thing could have been avoided if we had just armed teachers. And I thought, what kind of world do we live in? But we also can't hate that guy. I can't hate that guy. These are the people that we're called not to let turn into caricatures. These are the people that we're called to go the extra mile for. These are the people that Christ wants us to love. And it's obvious why this is hard. But it's not just hard to do on a sort of simple hate-love level. It's also hard to do because it's completely outside of our paradigm for understanding. The reason that Christ was crucified was not just because he told people what they were doing was wrong. What they were doing is wrong. They had plenty of teachers around to tell them that. The problem was that he wasn't doing it within the parameters of what they knew. Most people are able to accept correction as long as it lies within clear demarcations. Try to change the paradigm, however, and you create confusion, despair, and anger. In the Old Testament, even with all its well-intentioned rules, there is still a lot of room for Israel to hate its enemies. And human beings are primarily selfish and self-interested. And so when someone comes along and says that you have to start thinking about others once in a while, and even others who it makes more sense logically to hate, we have a problem with that kind of thinking. So what does this have to do with that third passage that I read? What does this have to do with the poor? I guess what I'm wondering is, what I've been wondering as I'm preparing is, do we see the poor as our enemy? Do I see a person of such meager means that he or she is forced to beg on the street as my enemy? Let me just try and qualify this a little bit. I just define enemy as someone, as being someone that I feel justified in hating, justified in seeing as less human than I am, justified in creating a caricature out of a human being because of some unrepentant wrong. When I see a panhandler crouched in the corner, freezing to death on a cold December afternoon, and I refuse to even acknowledge his presence, his very existence, and offer him judgment instead of a mere trifle of my money, am I treating him as a fellow human being? When I write off an entire race or people group because I see them as lazy or stupid or moochers, am I treating them as fellow human beings? When I give my few dollars to the Salvation Army Santa Claus ringing his silver bell in the warmth of Winnipeg Square, after having just passed a panhandler whose face I wouldn't even be able to vaguely describe, am I doing exactly what Christ describes when he talks about giving gifts in public? And that's not to say anything against the Salvation Army. They do great work, and they're an important part of our socially minded society. And I know that giving money to a beggar is not always helpful and can enable them to get worse. So I'm not saying you shouldn't give to the Salvation Army and just give all your money to someone on the street. But what does it mean for us to give of our time? What would it look like if we took a moment to look someone in the eye, to hold the door for a homeless person, to maybe express some interest in that same panhandler we see in the same spot every day? I don't know. I don't know exactly what it would look like, but it seems to me it might look something like another quote from Jesus. This is from Matthew 25, 31. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit upon his glorious throne, and all the nations will be gathered in his presence, and he will separate them as a shepherd separates sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep at his right hand and the goats at his left. Then the king will say to those on the right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you fed me. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in to your home. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you cared for me. I was in prison, and you visited me." Then these righteous ones will reply, "Lord, when did we ever see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink, or a stranger and show you hospitality, or naked and give you clothing? When did we ever see you sick or in prison and visit you?" And the king will tell them, "I assure you, when you did it for one of the least of these, my brothers, my brothers and sisters, you did it. You were doing it to me." Then the king will turn to those on the left and will say, "Away with you, you cursed ones, the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his demons. For I was hungry and you didn't feed me. I was thirsty and you didn't give me anything to drink. I was a stranger and you didn't invite me into your home. I was naked and you gave me no clothing. I was sick and in prison, and you didn't visit me." And then they will reply, "Lord, when did we ever see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and not help you?" And he will answer, "I assure you, when you refused to help the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you were refusing to help me." It's kind of interesting, this time of year with Advent and everything we've been reading, sort of the prophecies in Isaiah and all of these grand statements about what the Messiah was going to be. And I always find it strange how the great religious teachers of the time had all their predictions and all their ideas, and none of them got it even close to right about what Jesus was actually like. And sometimes I transfer that to our situation, and we have all these prophecies and revelation in different places, and we know what the end of the world is going to look like and what it's going to be like when Christ comes back. And then I read that, and I think, man, maybe we've missed the mark. Maybe we're expecting the wrong thing. And this isn't a fully fleshed out idea, so don't, if you disagree with me, don't jump down my throat. But I wonder sometimes if we're making a mistake waiting, because he's not coming back, because he's here. And this is how we meet him. I don't know. Anyway, disregard that if you want. That's a sermon for a different day. But this passage, more than anything else in the Bible, terrifies me, and it inspires me. It shapes my dealings with others. It shapes my feelings about giving. It shapes my perception of the history of the world and its leaders. It shapes my notions about God. It shapes my ideas about justice. It shapes my politics. And I hope that, although I'm sure this is not usually the case, I hope that it shapes how others perceive me. Perhaps Christ's entire purpose was not about a prayer to score some fire insurance. Perhaps God is more than just a vending machine eager to fill our orders. Perhaps the Holy Spirit is more than just parlor tricks. Perhaps the Bible is more than just a one-stop shop for quick fixes. Perhaps to truly understand what Christ was on about, we have to stop looking inward. And we have to resist the urge to feel comfortable before we help others. It seems pretty clear from Christ's teaching on the Sermon on the Mount that this is what he was trying to do. He was attempting to create a civilization in which the barriers between human beings fell, because human beings stopped putting them up so high. And in this season, the prevailing image of Christ that we have is the image of him as an infant. Now, in very few short weeks, I will probably be able to tell you a lot more about what it's like to live in close proximity with an infant. But for now, I'm just going to talk from the more general well of knowledge. You could ask. There's plenty of people here you could ask about. It's interesting because an infant represents the ultimate in helplessness. How long would a baby survive if he didn't have a caregiver? Is there any rational way to explain why humans are universally drawn to these screaming, stinky, hungry, needy bundles of frustration? These takers who give nothing in return but unconditional need and the occasional gassy smile? I don't know that there is. But, again, in a few weeks, maybe I'll be able to articulate that. But for now, I'm at a loss. Yet, for some reason, we cannot keep ourselves from loving these children and investing every ounce of our strength, every bit of our wisdom, every moment of our time, and every dollar from our wallets to make sure that these infants grow into intelligent, good-natured, well-adjusted, interesting adults who will then inexplicably go through this whole thing again. And we want to invest. We want to give our time and our energy. We want to make sure that this child has the very best. I couldn't even tell you the number of books and articles about babies that Jane and I have consumed over the past 7 months. We're going to go spend 4 hours this afternoon with this very interesting lady who will tell us about children, prenatal classes. I can't count the hours that I've spent thinking about and talking about this idea of what it means to be a father. I'm invested, and this kid isn't even born yet. But sometimes in these moments when I'm thinking about this, I start to think about the other children that have been born. The kids without role models or opportunities who will grow up to become adults that become write-offs because they can't fit into our society. I think about what Christ was talking about in Matthew 25. I think about the hungry, the thirsty, the strangers, the naked, the sick, and the prisoners. Am I not like one of those people that Christ talked about? The ones who love only their friends and despise their enemies? Or worse, I attack those I see as being below me with apathy. I refuse to even acknowledge the panhandler on the street. That is a murder. And when I belittle a person serving me because he or she got something wrong, that is a murder. And when I put my own selfish desire for a deal before the minimum wage of the discount department store employee who can't even afford to shop at the store she works at? That is a murder. When God showed up on this planet, he arrived as a helpless, stinky, screaming baby born into a barn. Can you imagine what somebody walking past that stable that night thought about the Holy Family? Mary and Joseph must have looked like a real bunch of deadbeats. Don't they care about their child at all? They couldn't possibly, or they wouldn't let be in this situation. A responsible parent would never have their baby in a barn. They would be looking at this family as caricatures because they weren't taking the whole story into consideration. They didn't know it. And so in that way, a murder would take place. And perhaps the reason that Christ came as a homeless refugee baby was to remind us that we never know the whole story about the people we see on the street, about the family member who seems to have gone off the rails lately, or about the old friend who can't seem to get his life together. We like to think that we wouldn't have scoffed at the Holy Family and their meager surroundings on the day that God became a man. But it's pretty likely that this December 25th, more than a few babies are going to be born to people who we'd rather not acknowledge. If we take Christ at his word, it means that when we consistently, systematically, and unrepentantly reject that child, or her parents, or her situation, or even the system of government, wherein those with the most are expected to give willingly a mere pittance of all that we have to ensure that everyone is better off, when we say that these things are hopeless, or wrong, or somehow unchristian, then we become one of the goats. We become the ones who are rejecting Christ on earth. And again, this isn't black and white. This isn't like a, like I said before, Christ wasn't coming to create a new rule book. But he came so that we could find a route to connection to him and with each other. This is about living the kingdom of heaven. When we act like Christ, we are creating heaven on earth rather than waiting for a place that we'll arrive at after death. We have the chance to give another person a glimpse of heaven. When we dismiss, ignore, or openly despise the less fortunate, the sick, the hurting, the marginalized, we are just giving them another look into the vacuum of loneliness that can only be described as hell. And I know that one day, when I come face to face with Jesus, I want to be able to look him in the eye. And so I guess the best way to practice is to start now, whenever I see him out on the street.